say, yo, from the Kingdom of Ohio, this is O'Culture, where we transmit tales from the Crypt Keepers of yore. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. I am Ryan Peverly, your party host, the apprentice, learning how to master his craft. As always, this podcast is penetrating your ear hole at 528 hertz. That's nothing but pure, unadulterated love dripping down into that ear canal. And things are about to get a bit more intimate because it's time to lay back and settle in for a long, hot, spine-tingling eargasm. And the man with the master plan for building us up to that is the Hermetic Hermit himself, Mr. Greg Stewart. Greg is a third-degree Blue Lodge Mason and a 32nd-degree Scottish Rite Mason. He's been called a Masonic Bodhisattva because of his quest to return Freemasonry to its esoteric roots. As a devoted student of the esoteric mystery schools, Greg is a firm believer in the Masonic connection to the Hermetic traditions of antiquity, its evolution through the ages, and its present configuration as the antecedent to most present-day esoteric and occult practices. Greg has explored the rites of Masonic initiation through a variety of initiatory systems with the goal of understanding the deeper meaning behind them. In that process, Greg's exploration has converged with mainstream and esoteric religious traditions, rituals of religious practice, and their intersecting undercurrents. Now, on the other side of that journey, the focus of his attention is on how those intersections relate to the Great Work, a subject he explores in a book series called Symbolic Lodge, which looks at the first 3 degrees of Blue Lodge Freemasonry and brings together aspects of Hermetica, the Kabbalah, the Tarot, and other esoteric and occult fields to help understand the hidden meaning at work in the Symbolic Lodge of Freemasonry. Greg previously maintained a blog called Masonic Traveler from 2005 through 2009, and you can read some of his essays and commentary from that blog in book form, published under the same name. Greg also formerly co-hosted and produced the Masonic Central podcast, the archives of which can be found, along with the rest of his personal great work, on the website freemasoninformation.com. Now, before we get into this, it's necessary to point out that Greg was wearing a headset microphone that gave us some slight feedback here and there throughout the conversation. I did my best to clean it up as much as I could for you guys, which meant a lot of extra work and delayed this episode a couple of days, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that. Anyway, without further ado, let's ado this damn thing. It's time to wax Masonically and cast this pod off into the mystical waters inhabited by one of the most maligned and perhaps one of the most misunderstood groups of our generation. Enjoy. All right, Greg Stewart, first of all, thanks for being here, man.
Hey, the pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this for a while now. I think the first thing that we need to do is construct a foundation here, which I think is a Masonic pun. But, you know, Freemasonry is a complex subject to talk about. So before we get into some of the more esoteric aspects of it, I have to ask you, what is Freemasonry exactly?
Good question. And depending upon who you ask, you get a variety of different answers. Most will center around the idea of it being a fraternity of men who gather together to go through a specific set of rituals in order to provide access, if you will, to an organization that spans close to probably more than 300 years, but it's actually celebrating its 300th year anniversary this year through the Grand Lodge of England. In its simplest terms, it's a social organization of individuals who gather together into this non-religious spiritual system of allegory and symbol through moral teachings. That is like a really complex definition. The simplest terms is that it's essentially a social club with rituals that is attractive to individuals who are looking for something deeper than themselves and looking for a group of people in which to associate with of like mind and go through this old system of initiation.
You know, I came across a couple different phrases in your book regarding Freemasonry and the different, I guess I don't want to say they're different types of it, but two of the things that I jotted down here were regular Freemasonry and continental Freemasonry. Is there a difference between those two?
Well, in my head, the way that I interpret it, so Continental Freemasonry is a term, if I'm remembering correctly, is sort of the American way of doing Freemasonry. So American Masonry comes out of Grand Lodge Freemasonry from England. So the United Grand Lodge of England, which is the foundation of where all Masonry comes from. Any quote-unquote regular chartered lodge gets a charter from a Grand Lodge, which has then a charter from the United Grand Lodge of England. So in a weird sort of sense, it's a franchise that stems all the way to the Home Office of England for it to be considered regular. So American Freemasonry has evolved, and it still follows that practice with charters, but it's evolved other groups and other associations that are concurrent with Freemasonry, but require a stepping stone of Freemasonry into them. So say the Scottish Rite, the York Rite, Shrine. And so Continental Freemasonry, in my eyes, is this sort of mushroomed up evolution of what it's become rather than just, a more, I hate to use the term meat and potatoes, but just the idea of a Masonic lodge that operates out of a specific city or area in England, and with a few additional bodies with it, but without the growth, let's say, that's happened here in America. So in America, it's broad. You have I want to say the numbers, just about a million now still Masons, big chunk that go into the Shrine, which is another organization that has followed, it parallels Freemasonry in the sense of its morals and what it does, but it operates differently because it functions as a national body. So it does things a little bit differently, has different charities and different focus. But again, the requirement in order to be in the Shrine is that you are a Mason, which may or may not be changing. It sounded like a few years ago that there was some upheaval or just some change within some states or within a state to no longer make being a Blue Lodge Mason, the first 3 degrees at the local lodge level, a requirement in order to be a member. But I don't think that's quite caught on yet, and I don't think that that's still as happening as much.
You know, I'm a layman here when it comes to Freemasonry, which I think is another pun, but you mentioned the Scottish Rite. I don't know. I think you mentioned the York Rite too, and then obviously the Shrine, but could you tell the listeners what the difference is between these different rites?
Well, so essentially they're different membership organizations within the main. So the let's start with the Scottish Rite. So the Scottish Rite follows a system that was elaborated and fleshed out by Albert Pike some 100 and some odd years ago under 32 degrees that are this progressive science of Albert Pike's construction, but based on his studies and his understanding of these things, elaborating on these systems of Masonry itself. So the first 3 degrees, which aren't really practiced, except for in some states, it goes into the fourth through 32nd degree, with the 33rd degree being the cap. At the end, which follow these different moral allegorical stories, building out the philosophies of Freemasonry. The York Rite follows a path that comes out of England. And in that sense, in my understanding, I'm sort of speaking off the cuff here, it follows a progressive line that evolved, that leads up to the Knights Templar. And there's a few orders beyond that, I believe. But going through the Blue Lodge degrees, becoming a York Rite Mason, which was a branch of Freemasonry at some point, becoming a Royal Arch Mason, and then going up into the Knights Templar, which loosely based on the original Knights Templar, if you will. And then the Shrine. So in America, it's the Shrine and Scottish Rite are the predominant secondaries. York Rite also, but not as much as those two. Shrine are the red fez wearing guys, and they do a lot with charity. So at the time of their founding, one of their main goals was to promote this idea of more active charity. And in that more active charity, have constructed this fantastic system of shrine hospitals that at one point was probably founded by them to a high degree, but that have gone on to become their own independent institutions with research and services provided, much like children's hospitals around the country where they're, if I believe, free of charge. Don't quote me on that. I don't have any documentation for that in front of me, but essentially they've made these children's hospitals, or these hospitals for children accessible to treat things that in the past were significantly troublesome that, you know, as time's moved on, the ailments have evolved, and so they've gone on to do other things. But they are functioning independent hospitals at this point that the Shrine still is associated with. But I want to say that they still raise money for them, but I don't think that they are independently able to fund them just because the institutions are so large.
Is the Shrine, is that the Antioch Shrine?
Or is that a different organization? Antioch Shrine. Is that may be a one body there. So within each state or territory, there are organized groups that govern that area. So Antioch Shrine might be one body.
Yeah, that's what it is near where I live here in the Dayton area of Ohio. I see the Antioch, you know, temple and shrine just kind of all throughout this area. So that's probably what you're talking about then.
Yeah, yeah. And so within each state and even within areas within states, there are groups just like that. And they function territorially. They manage and operate under their areas. I probably can't speak to too much extent to the shrine. That's just my general knowledge on it.
I did want to speak to a little bit of depth about the Scottish Rite, because I think that's probably what most people are familiar with in terms of these different bodies within Freemasonry. And the Scottish Rite's fascinating because, you know, you brought up Albert Pike. I'm sure people have heard of him and his famous philosophical treatise, Morals and Dogma. I know that this is an important text in the history of the fraternity, but I'm curious how much influence this text has over Freemasonry today.
That's a good question. When he wrote it, and this again is my understanding, when he wrote it, the book itself was assembled into this giant tome, and you can buy it on the internet, and you can buy facsimile copies of it, or even reset text copies of it. Or if you wander through any used bookstore, you'll find them generally on the shelf for anywhere between 20 and 50 bucks or more. They're these red cloth-bound books with gold emboss on them for the titles. At the time, the Scottish Rite, when it was organized, as memory serves, was sort of a loose collection of degrees after the Blue Lodge degrees that functioned, again, and we're talking 150 years or so ago, it functioned as a subordinate organization of the Blue Lodge, but it wasn't really codified. At the time they approached Albert Pike, being a big promoter of it, reorganized it to a degree, reconstructed the degrees, fleshed it out with writing parts and or whole degrees, and then giving his treatise on them through Morals and Dogma. The information itself has never quite been accepted as gospel by the body itself. So the entirety of the organization, besides a few people here and there, never put it on the shelf as like, this is rule and law. You know, let me pull it down and quote from here. Because the text itself, in context, isn't really meant to do that. I know within a lot of conspiracy circles, they point to Morals and Dogma as being, you know, this is the book of the Freemasons. In my opinion, it really isn't. It's a great philosophical exploration of the degrees, but taken out of context, I mean, you could read all kinds of stuff into it, but it's not until you put it in the context of the degrees themselves that things start to really make sense into what he's writing, how it associates, or even with what he's trying to say. You know, some of the great horrors of Pike is, you know, him calling Lucifer the Lightbringer. And without getting too much of that out of context, it definitely is a, whoa, what's this? But in context of the degree and what's happening in that particular degree, it's not fair. I don't think it's fair to try to understand it that way. In the past, I had looked at it and sort of scratched my head and thought, well, you know, why can't you just take these at face value? And it wasn't until I started into some of my own research and workings and trying to write and understanding this stuff that the works themselves, while having fantastic pull quotes and gems and nuggets of knowledge, shouldn't be taken out of context to read as, you know, here's this great philosophy that you should follow in this. Well, you can't unless you have either taken the degree or understand the degree and then try to put the two in parallel to say, okay, this is what's going on here. It's not, you know, here, do this, do that. You can't do this or you can't do that. It's associations of, you know, at this stage of your degree evolution, here's what these things mean. And at the next one, oh, here's what these things mean. At the next one, okay, well, here's what it means now. It meant that then, but this is a new way of looking at it. And it's not that you didn't understand it before, but you weren't in a position to understand this then until you've gone through it. So that's, I think, probably a fair way to assess how Morals and Dogma and Pike in particular wrote and approached these things. And that they it is not like a secret doctrine like Blavatsky. It's Morals and Dogma. It is a treatise on the specific degrees and trying to understand them in context of that degree and the vastness of the philosophy that's been put into them. Now, sometimes, you know, the guy would write on and on and on and pontificate and, you know, try to show how much he knows. But he was a smart dude, and he pulled a lot of these things together in the age really before, obviously, the internet, but even before, you know, having access to great libraries or access to scholars. He himself was a scholar. He did assemble a great library of texts, and the guy was well-read. He had absorbed a lot of this information and let it seep into the bones of Morals and Dogma. I mean, it's a fantastic text. It's dense and it's rich. And if you try to soak it in one page after the other, your eyes will go cross. And at the end, you'll be bloated and discontent after having done it. But it's something you have to marinate on. You have to read slowly and put it into context with the degree and what would happen. And so when the book was originally put out, it was put out and given to Scottish Rite Masons who would go through these degrees. And upon their completion, they were given this book, cap, and all the other stuff that goes along with it, with the hope that they would go home and then read it. So, okay, you've gone through these degrees, and now you can read up on what they're about. Anecdotally, I've heard stories that those books, that the most use that they got was to serve as door holders. So, you know, to hold a door open because it was so much information, because it was so rich. It was just hard for mass consumption. So the book itself is important for what's inside of it. But within Freemasonry, I wouldn't say that it's had the sway that some on the outside and conspiracy circles like to think that it has.
Yeah, you're talking about the degrees, and there seems to be a link between the 32 degrees of the Scottish Rite and the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Could you touch on that?
So, yeah, well, not knowing what was in Pike's head, I think that as you start to look at some of these symbolic things, these parallels start to show up. And even within the Scottish Rite degrees, but they don't lean into these very heavily, and they get to it in the fourth degree within the practice only superficially. The system itself, in my opinion, was constructed under that very idea. So the 10 sephira and the 22 paths to construct the Tree of Life. And as you start to follow the degrees, you move from sephira to path to sephira and so on and so forth, all the way up to the tree, eventually trying to understand all of these. So in Kabbalistic practice, so a non-Masonic practice, so in the true system of where these are, you know, so in the sense of meditating on these as particular paths in which you can go into and study and exist in, within Freemasonry, it's more, here are the philosophical stepstones between each, and you can still apply those other non-Masonic practices to the degrees, but I don't know how much of a service that is in the sense of trying to understand them in this context. So what I mean is that as you go into the first degree and try to understand the symbolism of it and the parallels within this Tree of Life schema, the parallels are there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you're meditating on this foundation and you know, the all the things in these other systems apply to it. It has its own specific take within Freemasonry. So as Pike constructed this, I believe it followed that process, and the practice says that it did, in order to impart those different aspects as the initiate progressed.
Yeah, I was just curious about that, because when you read and study the Kabbalah, it does sort of seem to parallel a lot of other teachings of mystery schools and esoteric organizations like the Freemasons. So it was just interesting. I didn't know the connection between that and the Scottish Rite, obviously, before I read your book, but it's not surprising, you know, because there were these lessons and knowledge that were handed down, you know, orally or written, you know, for centuries, right? So it just makes sense that it would seep its way into Freemasonry.
Absolutely. And strangely enough, they're within these systems, either of occult practice or these esoteric schools, there's been this need or desire to try to bring into them these older practices. So almost in a syncretic fashion, trying to weave these ideas of Kabbalah into it and other teachings as well, but weave it into their practice, either in order to legitimize it or because whomever was the author of it at the time found some great affinity with it, brought them in. So again, like so with Pike, you know, reading through the text and you start to understand how he's connecting the two. Even though he's bringing it in, it's still not so overt that it's, you know, here's what you need to know or here's how it applies. So, you know, in what would be like a common explanation today of like, this means that and this means this. It's subtle. It's way more subtle than that. And this is true of other mystery schools and esoteric teachings as well. You know, some are more overt. If memory serves, like the Golden Dawn or the OTO where it tries to parallel it in a much more firm way. This is in Masonry how it's evolved with Scottish Rite. So the 32 degrees, the paths in Sephra, the 33rd degree, which strangely enough, then now you start getting into Christian mysticism with, you know, when Christ perished on the cross, 33, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of intangible parallels here at work here, trying to validate and construct this, like I said, the schema of esoteric study, which underpins itself and at the same time mystifies as you go through it. And once you get to the end, it's a very long process. Very few ever end up to the end of it. But at the end, presumably you're, you know, this all-knowing being.
Let's stay on that for just a second. You know, we're talking about the ties that Freemasonry has to other esoteric groups and organizations. And we've already talked about the Knights Templar. You'll see that connection in popular culture a lot. And you'll also see a connection to groups like the Rosicrucians. But the influences of Freemasonry are a bit more complex and in some cases are much older than these groups. I think listeners may be surprised to know how far back the morals and dogma of Freemasonry actually go and what they're composed of. And you've written about esoteric Freemasonry and ideas and principles that came from Gnosticism, Hermeticism, and other various mystery schools that were absorbed into Freemasonry. I was curious if you could share with us what ideas and principles from these schools specifically that you're referring to and how Freemasonry was built around them.
I think so at its simpler, at the simplest of senses, in the terms of Gnosticism, so the ideas of knowledge, the ideas of gaining wisdom and understanding by wisdom and not just rote belief. In the senses of Hermeticism, in the sense of initiation, of being a craftsman to build in parallel with the divine and understand, and this is part of one of my interpretations, in that sense of empowering oneself as a divine being to have your ability to create. Those in particular, I think that systems have evolved with these as Freemasonry goes, intentional or unintentional, it's almost impossible to say. I think it in its earliest fashion that Freemasonry wasn't about these things, that it probably began through the Stonemason Guilds or similar guilds, not necessarily the Stonemason Guilds, but guilds all the same, and over time began to fetishize, if you will, the works that they were undertaking and then bring them into their practice. So in the third book, you mentioned the two books that I had. In the third book that I'm working on right now, it touches on some of this in the sense that mystery plays were a tremendous influence on these early guilds in the sense that they functioned, sure. They would cut stone and do whatever other trades that they were doing within their local areas. And either as recreation or as part of their community service or just in part of this ritual play pageantry that would take place throughout England, they would adopt these plays of biblical or philosophical parallels in order to entertain or convey the message and so on. I mean, it's impossible to say that you know, which guild did what. The records on a lot of these mystery plays exist, but it's not it doesn't have the encyclopedic cataloging that would happen today in the sense of documenting, you know, who did what, where, and when. But we do have histories of these mystery plays taking place and the specific guilds doing specific things. I don't have anything in front of me that I could pull right now as a reference, but essentially, let's say you'd have, in this example, the Masons guilds or the marblers, who were the ones who cut stone, doing these mystery plays on Solomon's temple. And so as time progressed, the pageantry would progress, and the symbolism would begin to seep into that and start to affect the writing. And so as time moves on, people start studying more into it, finding other parallels, connecting, and so on and so forth, into about the time that we get to Pike and earlier writers and even later writers who fetishize it even more and romanticize it and then construct these systems. Not to say that these systems didn't exist in some fashion prior to that, that you know, there weren't Judaic scholars who studied the Kabbalah or Rosicrucians who came out of the early writings of Rosicrucianism and people following these things. But as time has gone on, these Western mysteries have evolved and begun to seep into one another, where they've adopted or dropped, cut, added different aspects in either in ways to legitimize themselves or just in finding parallels with it in the sense of, oh, that's what we're doing, maybe this fits. Not in all senses, but idyllically maybe, or just in wanting to have affinity with it. And so then as Freemasonry has gone on in this very simple, not super esoteric sense, other groups have come up, such as the Golden Dawn, that borrowed these systems and then elaborated further on it. Founded by mostly Masons, again with the OTO as well, they founded by Masons, evolved into the fashions that they have. And then as you start getting into the 20th century, where different groups, Rosicrucians would come up, or the Builders of the Adytum, writers who would take from these ideas and evolve up their own. Again, thinking that they were unique and doing something original, but still borrowing from these older traditions. So again, back to the idea of it being a syncretic system, they were evolving these ideas into new ones, keeping some aspects, discarding others, and creating different understandings of them. And so that's how this melange of esotericism and the Western mystery tradition, I think, has evolved. Manly Hall, early in the 20th century, writing on this, captured a lot of that in his study of it, right or wrong in what he was saying in much of him, but still trying to construct an idea of what all these systems have evolved into, where they came from, you know, in some sense pulling back to Egypt or to Mesopotamia or what have you. But still, I mean, these are sort of a Western phenomena. This is the Western evolution of a lot of these ideas into these non-traditional spiritual traditions of trying to find oneself and trying to evolve human understanding and human conscious.
Well, when it comes to the influence of, you know, things like hermetic magic and alchemy and alchemical thinking, you cited guys like John Dee, Cornelius Agrippa, Paracelsus, Francis Bacon, Giordano Bruno as influences on Freemasonry with their writing and their work. Are these figures revered in Freemasonry at all? Is their work taught to Masons, or does the fraternity encourage the study of their work?
On the surface, no, they're not. They're sort of these dark, not dark figures. They're not really promoted in the sense of, like, you know, here's a list of people to go read. These are sort of the secondary, even tertiary figures in the history of Freemasonry that whose writings have contributed in some sense of the changing understandings of the time, which likely allowed those thoughts to seep into the fraternity. So Freemasonry itself sets itself as a 300-year-old fraternity, and their anniversary being this year, with the United Grand Lodge of England. Records go back even further to place Freemasonry, I don't have it in front of me, but about 100 years maybe before that, record-wise. So the likelihood is that it stretches back even further back into the 16th century or so, and probably even earlier than that, when we start getting into the stone guilds and the associations of individuals gathering together to practice some sort of activity like that, or to have non-traditional, or who had this non-religious spiritual intercourse like that. And so that's where figures like John Dee come in, or Agrippa, or Paracelsus, or even the translations of the Hermetic texts that happened under the Medicis. When the Medicis got their hands on these texts, they realized the importance of them, had them translated. They stopped translating philosophies, put these texts first, with Ficino, I believe. And that's when they seeped back into Western Europe, and the ideas began to permeate back into this underground of thought. And we're going back now to the early Renaissance. So these ideas, again, it's there's not like a stack of text or people that you could say this influenced that, this influenced this, to this, to this, to this. I've tried to draw these parallels. I've tried to create a timeline or a spreadsheet of some kind to understand what this progression has looked like, and it's a mess. It's all over the place because the ideas and the people seem to come in from so many different sectors. But you know, one person reads a book here and it influences their writings later. Another person reads a text here and it influences their writing there. It's not a clean lineage of this to that to this. You know, it's not like we could say with Da Vinci's flying machine that there's a clear path. I mean, it's not really a clear path, but it's not like there's a direct clear path to Kitty Hawk and to the space shuttle. You know what I mean? There's a lot of meandering, a lot of different attempts or tries at different things with different outcomes that led to different things. So in particular, what I'm referring to is like, say, the Rosicrucian lines, with the Rosicrucian writings, the 1500s or so, led to different ideas and different understandings. Not to say that Freemasonry didn't borrow some, but it's led to its own thing with organizations that have come up in the subsequent centuries, such as a Mork or other Rosicrucian groups who drop paths back to those original writings, but have adopted or evolved different ideas of them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where aspects of magic and these other sort of spiritual practices come in. You know, even to take, like, say, Aleister Crowley understood a lot of these things and evolved these ideas through his works. And I am by no means an expert on him, but just in reading his works and his understandings and his biography to see how these things influenced him and influenced his thinking. You know, it started with an idea and you evolve that idea and you read more and you read more. You know, there's no great, like the movies, there's no great epiphany one day of like, suddenly I'm an occult magus with unlimited knowledge. I mean, it that just doesn't happen. So these things begin in slow progression, step by step, with subtle understandings that evolve through time, that evolve through writings and through publishing. You know, it's different. It's interesting to see what'll happen in the next 50 to 100 years with the internet and the profusion of information to see if these things solidify into more significant organizations or if it just becomes so diffuse into the common knowledge of the public that a lot of these groups just sort of evaporate into philosophical ideas that have come and gone.
Yeah, for sure. One of the parallels that you draw in your work is the sort of similarity between the degrees and the alchemical process of creating the Philosopher's Stone. And that idea of creating this stone has been around for eons, it seems, whether it's a physical object created during an actual scientific process or something that relates more to, you know, mind and spirit, which is, I think, where Masonic thought is when it comes to alchemy. You actually describe this alchemical transformation in Freemasonry. You say, quote, "There is no philosopher's stone created, nor a transformation of lead into gold performed. Instead, what the alchemy of Freemasonry strives to make is the transformation of the untamed, rough, individual man towards a refined and controlled stone, contributing towards the betterment of himself and, in course, fitting into civil society." And that's a great summary of what Freemasonry is really all about.
I would say that's probably true of a lot of organizations, but thank you very much. Please feel free to go on. I mean, So as you start to get into these ideas, there are certainly individuals out there who have taken alchemy to very far reaches. Timothy Hogan is one who's a sharp guy and has spent the time in trying to create these transmutations, these alchemical transformations of one thing or another, of physical tangible things. There's certainly no doubt that a degree of alchemy exists in the ferment of chemistry, which is an evolution out of alchemy. So that is a science that exists. In the sense of trying to create mythological powered things to either promote longevity or eternal life or something of the like. I mean, these to me are allegorical stories that are trying to inculcate what I said in that quote, this idea of transformation, because in that process of trying to create this, certainly there's going to be change in the properties that are going into it. In the sense of tangible changes to the individual, it's a horrible cliche, but an opening of the third eye to understand the changes at work. And then once you're through that, to have this change of personality, I am a different person having undergone these things. You know, that when you started, you weren't the same. You weren't the person that you were downstream because of your experiences with it, because of things that you've read or things that you've looked at and tried to understand in your own head. That it's one thing to try to find the parallel with this real and physical search for this philosophical philosopher's stone with it being this inner transformation. You are trying to create that within yourself. You are trying to create transformation, which is at the heart of Freemasonry. It's this process of coming in this rude and uncut state and becoming a person who tries to do better, a person who wants betterment for society, a person who wants betterment for themselves, for their associates, and who strives for those things. Now, whether or not the day-to-day operations of a lodge or of masonry itself functions like that's another story, but the individualized, personalized take on these things is essentially what's happening. You're coming in as a neophyte and you're leaving as a master. I don't know how you could have any other outcome at the end besides being transformed by calling yourself a master.
Yeah, I think it's important to note too that, you know, we're talking about mastering yourself, and that's the ideas that are, you know, evident in, you know, Gnosticism and Hermeticism. It's all about acknowledging the presence of a divine being inside of you and not having to rely on, you know, an intermediary like a priest to attain, you know, a connection to that. It's already inside of you. And that's, I think, the important thing to note here is that these teachings are no different than what you hear in Gnostic and Hermetic thought. You wrote that this is not a path to a celestial home, but how we can attain a connection to it. And that's, I think, that encapsulates everything that we've been talking about here. But this does beg a question for me. Do Freemasons have a certain cosmology of the universe then, or any beliefs on how humanity was created or what our purpose is here on Earth? Or is that just part of the personal belief system for each individual Mason?
The system itself does not have, like, does not have a statement of faith. So you know, where if you walk into a church, a lot of times they'll advertise what their particular church's statement of faith is. You know, like, we follow the Nicene Creed, we follow the blah, blah, blah. There's nothing that exists like that. For most masonry, the requirement of admittance is simply a belief in a supreme being, call it God. There's a strong aversion to, let's say, agnostic or atheist thought. So if you came to it and say, I'm an atheist and I don't believe, but I want to be a member, the likelihood that of your getting in would be probably slim to none. But for the individual who recognizes supreme being, in most states, in most places, there will be no test as to what that is. So, you know, you could believe in the flying spaghetti monster, I suppose, and insofar as you don't try to tell people or try to convert them to belief in the flying spaghetti monster, there probably wouldn't be any issue. I mean, I say that tongue in cheek. Mm-hmm. In the subtext of Freemasonry, though, there is a very pervasive idea of all religions being acceptable Because again, if you were to go up to a lodge and whether a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, a follower of the Jewish faith, it takes in individuals of all faiths. And so in that sense of taking in individuals of all faith, being a spiritual organization, in my opinion, creates almost this spiritual bubble around it of all faiths. And I think in my eyes, that's where we come back to these ideas of a hermetic teaching, in the sense that if it's all faiths being under this one true religion, something that Pike in Morals and Dogma oftentimes brings up and mentions and weaves throughout. You know, I just pulled off of my shelf a copy of Hermetica and just flipping through in one of the places that, you know, I've both highlighted and underlined, and in one spot underlined each word 4 and 5 times, saying, and this is a quote coming out of Hermetica. This is out of the 12th Discourse of Hermes Trismegistus, where it says, "There is but one religion of God, and that is not to be evil," which, I mean, in a sense, is what Freemasonry teaches. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's very big on this idea of the golden rule of do unto others. You know what I'm saying? And as you start to look through all these different faiths, all these different faiths have that very same or very similar phrasing of that same rule. You know, again, intentionally or otherwise, it's an interesting creation within the system that has fostered for itself this ideal, whether intentional or not, of being this sort of organization, and yet stuck in an idea of itself as being a probably a Christian organization, but not really a Christian organization, but having the morals and tenets of all these others. So, I mean, in particular, you start looking at Freemasonry as a practice, and it reveres Solomon's Temple very strongly. Well, Solomon's Temple obviously is in the Bible, but it's also in the Judaic text. You know, it's an Old Testament reference. So it's less about a modern new covenant as it is about older tradition. So again, we're dealing with syncretic issues here that are at odds with itself within the organization to reconcile it, but at the same time embracing it fully by its very existence.
Yeah, you do make a distinction, or not you necessarily, but Freemasonry does make a distinction between religion and faith, and I think that's what we're talking about here in a nutshell, is that, you know, Freemasonry is not a religion. They accept all faiths. They don't force you to believe in anything. So I don't know if it's a common misconception, but I know it is one of the misconceptions that people have about Freemasonry, right?
Absolutely. I have struggled with many of folks on this over the years, in the sense of, is it, isn't it? I'm in the camp to say that it's perfectly okay to call it a religion, that it's, I think people fear it because of by calling it a religion would alienate those who are part of it and who are very affirmed in their own faiths, and it would run afoul of that. And so as a philosophical organization, it cannot embrace that. It just can't, because if it did, then anybody who followed another faith would look at it and say, well, this is apostasy. I can't be a part of this. And so as an organization, it doesn't. So in a weird sense, and actually in one of the books that you'd mentioned that, and I've posted this on Freemason information all over the place, but Freemasonry is almost like a religion of not being a religion. So it's a religious practice, with all the trimmings of tradition and ceremony and even philosophy, but without being a religion in the sense of telling people to pray to this, to burn a calf for that, or to take penance for doing this. So it would be hard to justify it as a quote unquote religion, but it certainly flirts right at the edges with it in a lot of different ways. And like I said, in the practice, in the tradition, you know, even as you start to deconstruct the word religion, it's the bringing forward of past traditions. So, you know, that's essentially what's being done here. You know, the ceremonies and the rituals that are being practiced.
Yeah. And I mean, although the term religion has been kind of, you know, perverted over the past few centuries, it seems, just because of, it seems like, you know, anyone can start one. and get a tax ID for it, you know, so it kind of waters down, you know, the actual meaning of it. That's just my take on it.
Well, I don't think you're right. You know, not to quote pop culture here, but if you've ever watched John Oliver on HBO's Last Week Tonight, at one point, I believe in the last season of 2016, he founded a religion. He, no joke, actually, I mean, the process isn't that hard. It's a little bit of paperwork and just to assemble a following of some sort. But with the idea in that program to be able to collect donations. I mean, it was tongue in cheek the entire way, but it showed the simplicity of this process and just the disdain maybe for the true working of religion. So yeah, I mean, anybody could found a religion. You and I, we could finish this call and we could say, hey, let's draw up a rough constitution, form a nonprofit, and, you know, we'll call it the occult church, and boom, start being able to take donations and hold services and have people hang out. I mean, it, stranger things have happened. So in that sense, Freemasonry exists, and it doesn't want to go down that realm, because I think of the implications of doing something like that. Of, not that it wants to skirt the responsibilities, but to hold those responsibilities in the sense of functioning in that fashion, that it would probably suffer the same fate as many religious churches today and just become anachronistic. What's the word I'm looking for? It would become an illusion of what it was trying to be. Anachronistic, I think, is the word I was looking for. It would become anachronistic in the sense of its function, trying to continue doing something that just wasn't as contemporary anymore. I don't know, am I making any sense with that?
Yeah, you absolutely are making sense. I saw a quote somewhere, I think it was like a stand-up comedian or something, and he said something about, like, religion is just a cult with better leaders, something like that. I probably butchered that quote, but yeah. You know, you mentioned you pulled out a copy of the Hermetica, and we've been talking about, you know, Hermetic influence on Freemasonry. There's actually a long tradition of Hermetic philosophy in America, which dates back to the founding of the country. And we've been told that many of the country's founding fathers were Freemasons, which seems to elicit a generally negative response from people who see Freemasons strictly as a nefarious group. But, you know, like, as we've been talking about, the principles of Freemasonry, which are essentially similar to the principles of Hermeticism, are not nefarious at all, unless you're the Catholic Church or a group like that, I guess. But I did want to outline briefly the seven Hermetic principles that play a role in the degrees of Freemasonry. So if you could you share what those seven principles are and how they fit into the fraternity?
I can, and let me preface this first, that this is an idea based on another text, so not a typical traditional Hermetic text, but actually a later addition to the Hermetic philosophy by the three builders. It's a book called The Kabbalion, and most people who have been in this pool of esoteric thought have heard of the Kabbalion. You could find it online for very cheap on Amazon and most occult type styled bookstores, but it still is a treasure when folks come across it for the first time and are taken by it because of what it talks about. So, you asked specifically what they were, and in the text that I wrote under Masonic Traveler, the seven principles are the principle of mentalism, the principle of correspondence, the principle of vibration, the principle of polarity, the principle of rhythm, the principle of cause and effect, and the principle of gender. And each of them are fairly true to what their titles are. I won't get into the meat of it. I'll let others either try to dig it up and read it, or certainly go out and get the book. But really what this particular section of the book and what this text is about, it is finding parallels within Freemasonry as to these specific sections of the Kabbalion and what you could take away from it as a student going either through the degrees or just in trying to understand them from an esoteric occult, if you will, point of view. I should add that the Kabbalion was actually written by individuals who were Freemasons, if I'm not mistaken, Paul Foster Case being one of them. And then a couple of others, I believe it was William Atkinson's and Michael Witte, who won Witte from the Golden Dawn, as well as Atkinson's and Case being the founder of Builders of the Adytum, Both the organizations still going on today. Whether or not they're going strong is another story, but still in existence. And both with very unique takes on this sort of Western mystery tradition. So with these seven principles, essentially to, and I'll pull this from memory, but down the line. So the principle of mentalism is essentially the strength of mind and having thought to create. Let's go back to the list here. Principle of correspondence, how one thing relates to another. Principle of vibration, how one thing reacts to another. So the vibrations between the two, you know, positivity generates positivity, negativity generates negativity. Principle of polarity, the opposites of things on a spectrum. So positive to negative, how they can flip, where they interact. Principle of rhythm, that is how those two things interact and associate with one another. Cause and effect, obviously cause and effect. You push something over, it'll fall over. If you start an action, it puts that action in motion, which will then result in whatever your outcome is that you put the effort into. And then the principle of gender, which gets into a very touchy subject, if you will, for a lot of individuals, especially with Freemasonry, but it talks about the gender being both a male and female at work within systems, within people. So essentially we as individuals, a male has female principles in them and vice versa, and how those things come out. And it doesn't mean, you know, you necessarily fall into the cliches of, you know, sensitivity or maternalism or, you know, of the like, but it certainly is an understanding, and it maybe in a more philosophical way, it's about trying to understand things from a different perspective or that ability of trying to relate to something in the sense of the thing, its place in the planet and the spiritual heavens and so on. Just in a Masonic sense, it in something that I wrote back when I put this down on paper is that it's the work between the labor of the lodge and the ritual. So it's the form and the function, if you will. So that would be one way of taking gender. I hope I didn't like butcher these for anybody who comes back and say, you didn't say any of that in this. But I mean, that in a nutshell is what these are about. I mean, and this is interpretations out of the Kabbalion. If anybody listening has not ever read the Kabbalion, I recommend it. It's probably one of the few go-to books on my shelf as just sort of a spiritual, not primer, but just sort of a spiritual, I need to uplift. Let me pull some passage out or read something and just try to see if I can pep myself up.
Yeah, I actually have two copies of it on my bookshelf because I have like a very conspiratorial view on publishing these days, but I'm always interested if ancient texts get, you know, kind of reinterpreted somehow when they're published, you know, as new editions. So I bought an older version and I bought a newer version. I want to see if they were any different, and they don't seem very different to me, but I do kind of question, like, when things are published long ago and then they're republished, you know, now in more modern times, I just wonder if there's anything changed, and if so, what was changed? Because it does seem like, for example, the Hermetic connection here, the Hermetic principles and philosophies that we've been talking about, it seems like they sort of disappeared from mainstream culture when not that long ago, everybody knew what they were. Scientists, philosophers, they all studied this stuff and believed in it. And I was wondering if, you know, I brought up the Catholic Church earlier. Do you think that the Catholic Inquisition or any other sort of group maybe played a role in deliberately squashing these principles and their connections to groups like the Freemasons?
I don't know if I would say deliberate. There's a weird intentionality behind saying deliberate. I also don't know if I would say that these ideas were whole cloth accepted as being right and true or even as being fundamental. I think within certain segments of particular followers of these things that there was a degree to which they were philosophically followed, you know, not in any rote practice, but just in general principle. So I guess the first thing to say to that is that I don't think that these things were ever like the bread and butter of daily life. As to the Catholic Church, I will say that obviously the Catholic Church is in the business to be the Catholic Church, and they will do at various times what's in their power to change things that either may be a threat to them or that are a threat to what they see as their dominion of power. I mean, just looking at some of the encyclicals on Freemasonry is to I think it was Human Genius that talks about Freemasonry being a syncretic organization that adopts all these other ideas and weaves them into the work. So in that sense, I think that they have stepped in to try to dictate or exercise some authoritative control on it. But, and this is an opinion that's come to me late in this understanding, as much as they've done that, they're not doing that for the broader public. So it's not like they're trying to influence these ideas to, you know, the lay person or the Gentile in the street. This is for people within the Catholic Church who obviously already follow its practice and tenets and influence their opinions on aspects of either these esoteric or occult practices, of Freemasonry in particular, or even of science. I mean, just look at some of their early works in trying to suppress aspects of science, things that we take for granted today. You know, the Earth traveling around the sun and the sun moving, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? So just in those scientific ideas in trying to exercise dominion and control over them. So I think within the sense of their trying to influence it, maybe at those times there were a greater number of Catholics in society, and so by trying to influence their thought, they were trying to influence a greater swath. And maybe that's probably an argument that could be made, but I don't think that they exerted that sort of control and authority over society, at least not for a very long time. Let's go back to Paracelsus, who was burned at the stake for these sorts of philosophical ideas. Then maybe, you know, they had a lot more control. But in the more, you know, contemporary or current times, you know, at least the last couple hundred years, I know the Catholic Church doesn't really like Freemasonry, and it's denied the Eucharist to, I believe it's the Eucharist, right? They've denied the Eucharist to Freemasons. But if you talk to regular guys who are Masons and go to Catholic churches, they ask their pastor, and the pastor says, I don't care. You know, so I mean, there's no lock and step in how these things are practiced. You know, you don't have Catholics marching up to Masonic lodges and throwing firebrands or spray painting, you know, Masons go away. You know, you have other people doing stuff like that or doing stupid things like that, thinking that Masonry is some evil body. But, you know, that's a whole nother story. And I don't think that any of that's associated with this sort of organized religious practice, not coming from the Catholic Church now.
Well, that's a fair point, man. You know, yeah, I didn't mean to come off too conspiratorial there, but just...
No.
If history has taught me anything, it is that, you just said this too, that they have tried to exert their power and influence whenever possible. So, and you talked about burning at the stake. Bruno was burned at the stake for very similar ideas. So I was, you know, just kind of made me wonder if maybe during the Inquisition, if they didn't just try to stamp out, you know, these hermetic principles in Freemasonry, but... That would not have been the entire purpose of the Inquisition, obviously, but I just thought maybe it wasn't just a byproduct of it. But transitioning to something else, I've seen mentions of an Egyptian rite of Freemasonry. I had come across a story recently that I've been researching for a solo podcast that I'm putting together. This guy named Cagliostro, who was quite a character back in, I forget what time period it was now, but there's a story that he was trying to spread this Egyptian rite of Freemasonry. And in your book, you do talk about Freemasonry being a continuation of Egyptian mystery schools, for example, but nothing about an actual Egyptian rite. So was this story about Cagliostro spreading an Egyptian rite, is that true? Was there or is there such a thing?
Before I answer that, let me just say, you're absolutely right. I did say Paracelsus burned at the stake, and it was Bruno. So let me correct myself. With the Egyptian rite in Cagliostro, Pip Falks did a book some years ago that's actually coming out soon as a republish on that talks about him and this Egyptian rite. And he's an interesting fella, to say the least. If memory serves, I have. So with the notion of Egyptian Freemasonry, as you start to dig into this esoteric school, a lot of the writers, so from Case to Manly P. Hall, Pike to some degree, and others, even let's say Aleister Crowley, they find this tradition that goes back to a period of time out of Egypt that either through cults of the dead or through the Book of the Dead had these practices. If memory serves with Cagliostro, he evolved these rites. And back at the time of Cagliostro, he constructed these degrees, or this Egyptian rite, at a time that was ripe for these practices, these little theaters of degrees, if you will. I mean, mind you, this is the time well before books, the prevalency of books, or the accessibility of books or entertainments. And so there was within society, there was a great practice of these rituals, of these entertainments. And so his was sort of along those lines. And he likened it to these magical practices or these, the pursuit of the philosopher's stone, of alchemy. And whether or not he was right or not right, who knows, you know, but he could come in and talk a good talk. And had constructed these in order to create a new order, you know, much the same way as Case or Crowley or you know, the guys at the Golden Dawn and so on. So,
yeah, I was just curious about that because I was unfamiliar with him until I started doing some research on this thing that I'm working on. And it's funny you mentioned Pip Falk. I just traded some messages with her on Facebook this morning.
Right.
I'm trying to get her on the show here to talk about this book. Do you know Pip at all?
I do. I interviewed her, and I knew her quite some time ago. I'm actually there. She's re-releasing. I've been in touch with her publicist, and she's re-releasing her book. Mm-hmm. What is it called?
It's called The Masonic Magician.
Yeah, that's it. She's re-releasing it, and it talks about it, and she constructs this history of this guy who charlatan, not charlatan, you know, they in a lot of this esoteric tradition that seems to be always nipping at the heels of it is this level of charlatanism of whether or not it's true or not true. You know, with John Dee, you had that with the Edward Kelly, you know, the whole idea of the Rosicrucian order with the Mork and its history of Spencer. Even with Crowley and the OTO and just his evolutions of Thelema, not that they were, I'm not claiming any of them as being charlatans, but there's always an air of this, you know, genuine disingenuousness to it. And so with his rites with Cagliostro, Balsamo, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's fun to read. It's fun to remember, but what, the permeation of his efforts never really took off. I want to say that his system continued, but I have never gone that deep into it just because it's always been like one of those things at the very edges. But the Rites of Memphis Mizraim, which mm-hmm. is if you Google it, you'll actually find the website to it and you can join it. And I hate to use this term, but like this fringy sort of masonry that exists with these Egyptian rites. That's what I want to say that some of his work has evolved into.
You know, speaking about charlatanism, I had came across a quote during my research about Cagliostro, and I forget who I'm quoting here, but this guy said that, you know, biographies of adepts were not meant to be taken literally, and they were often exaggerated to make the adept seem more mystical than he really was, even though, you know, they probably were on some level very mystical. But yeah, I don't know how much of his story is true and not true. And I think that's probably what people like that want us to think. You know, it's like, we don't know what's true. We don't know what's not true. It's exactly what they want, right?
I don't know. Is it what they want?
I don't know either. I'm just guessing.
I mean, it's certainly worth the consideration, but I don't know if it's so much what they want or just more indicative of how they existed. You know what I mean? So is it that they wanted to be interpreted as being mysterious, or were they mysterious? And is that just more indicative of their personality and their character that, mm-hmm. that, you know what I mean? So I mean, there's a level of intentionality there. Sure, maybe the showman wants to be seen, you know, as flashy and sequin covered and sparkly, but some of these things take a tremendous amount of work. I mean, obviously, putting together a podcast, you know how much work goes into that. Putting together a book takes a tremendous amount of work. Building websites, putting together whole organizational systems. I mean, in today's parlance, a lot of these things are tremendous works that take teams of people, you know, dozens and dozens. I mean, just think of an app for your phone. A good one takes a lot of people to make sure all the pieces are there together. With some of these old guys in the systems that they put together, so Pike in particular, this Cagliostro, Crawley, I mean, these guys are all patriarchs for me in the sense of these guys did this stuff on their own. They sat in probably dusty rooms writing and scrawling on paper and thinking about this stuff. So whether or not they wanted to be remembered as this flash in the pan, or not flash in the pan, but as this, you know, this spectral figure of occult magic, and I don't think that that's what you think about when you do these things. Maybe once you start to aggrandize it, or you get people who follow your system or to join or to send, I don't know if that's true. I think that these are philosophical thinkers who were willing to put their ideas down and to construct some system or some, I can't think of the word. Think of some cosmology as to what it all means, and just sort of put it out there to see who would pick it up. You know, not to draw parallels to Christianity at all, but I mean, in some sense, is this any different than someone challenging the authority of the time, a la Jesus Christ, and questioning its existence? You know, this doesn't work like that because of this, and here's why, and let me stand by it. You know what I mean? So like, I mean, I just had to pull it up just to refresh my own memory, but so like Cagliostro, he did this stuff and the Inquisition got him. So, you know, who in their right mind would do this stuff knowing that someone would come after him, someone with convictions? Is that wanting to be remembered that way, or being that way, or is it really just standing on what they believed in? Maybe he just wanted to bilk people out of dues money and give himself a little pension to live on.
Well, that was a claim that he was sort of a, you know, kind of a fraud and just took people for what they were willing to give him. So
right,
that's a fair point. Well, hey, yeah, it's a fair point.
But I mean, but in the same sense, think of like John Dee. Who can say what he was doing? I mean, was he really scrying and seeing stuff in a black obsidian stone?
Well, he wasn't.
Who knows, you know?
No,
I mean,
no,
the guy
no.
who wrote his...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
John Dee wasn't the actual scryer. It was Ed Kelly, but...
No, but still, with the practices, you know what I mean? Dee was the one that was staring the stone. Kelly was his secretary with it.
No, no, it was vice versa.
Or the other way around.
So Dee couldn't scry. Dee was the one, he sat there while Ed Kelly stared into the crystal ball,
okay,
you know, so to speak, and then Kelly relayed the messages from the angels to Dee, but there were some messages. I actually joked about this with somebody else on a podcast just recently. You know, there's this great story about Kelly telling Dee that the angels told him that they needed to swap wives because Dee's wife Dee's wife was like pretty attractive and Kelly's wasn't. So I thought that was great. And that just goes to show you like how full of shit some of these people probably are.
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean that some of what they were doing wasn't, you know, true or accurate either.
You know, the irony, and this will probably make some listeners mad who maybe are following it, but you know, you start looking at Joseph Smith and some of his,
oh yeah,
you know what I mean? The parallels there of like, yeah, I looked into this and it told me blah, blah, blah.
It told me I could have 12 wives and they, you know,
yeah,
some of them can be underage.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to besmirch people and I don't want to besmirch faith. I'm certainly not about that at all. And that's a whole nother thing that if ever you wanted to get into is looking at the parallels between Freemasonry and Mormonism, is a whole wild ride.
Wasn't Joseph Smith a Freemason?
Yeah.
And
if memory serves, a lot of the foundational aspects of the church, but even in the practice that still happens today, I mean, wearing aprons with certain symbols and grips and words almost feel like it, you know, in Pikean fashion, lifted out of Freemasonry and just evolved into this other thing. In some really weird aspects, if I can't verify this with any sort of bibliography or reference, But my gut tells me that if you were to take Freemasonry and religionize it, that it would be very similar to Mormonism. So you take the practice of the lodge and turn it into a religious function. Now, again, I couldn't one-to-one, you know, oh, this relates to that, this parallels here, blah, blah, blah. But just the bits and pieces, because a lot of the aspects of Mormonism are fairly kept fairly secret. I mean, there are some things that are leaked and, you know, they talk about certain things, in the open, but it's the leaked stuff that it's like, oh, okay, that there's weird aprons here. What are these weird aprons? And, you know, these, even in following these sort of hermetic aspects of there being a god in heaven and that you become a god, you know what I mean? So as you start to unwrap this stuff, you know, you can maybe loosely say that there's some hermetic connections to it, but it you know, it's evolved. It's just this philosophy evolved. Which maybe, you know, we are in the immediate time right now, and so we can only look plus or minus to ourselves to within a certain degree. Who's to say in 100 years? You know what I mean? 200 years, what comes of it?
Absolutely, man. So, you know, transitioning back to something that you wrote about in your book, Masonic Traveler, you wrote that Freemasonry has always been a system of symbols, but that the symbols of Freemasonry are no longer studied by members. That's curious to me because when you really start to research and study the occult, you learn how important and how powerful symbols and symbology is. I was wondering why the symbols of Freemasonry are no longer studied. What do you attribute that to?
Good question. So at its surface level, I would say that what you could attribute it to is a overabundance of other things to think about. You know, the great cry of authors or even, I want to say Masonic apologists, but just people who write about or think about Freemasonry is that there's just too many distractions. Television, radio, internet, books, I mean, basically anything else other than this. Because studying the Masonic symbols is a lot of work. It's not just let me use a flashcard that'll tell me what this thing is today. You know, and this is probably true of a lot of different systems, and not just Freemasonry. You know, it's a interesting parallel with how many Christians have read the Bible cover to cover. You know, sure, they'll open it and read certain things or if they've read parts of it, but have they really, like, absorbed the entire thing? So the same thing's true with Freemasonry. You know, there's not a lot of sources. So there's not a lot of, like, here's an authoritative book. There's Freemason for Dummies by Chris Hodapp. Very good. Complete Idiot's Guide of Freemasonry. There's a countless number of books in stores or in places that you can get from Masonic authors over the years who have written about Freemasonry to pick up and read. But they're dense. They are not easy. Let me just take small bites and digest this in little pieces. So it's a lot of work. Also, I you know, some would argue that it's the individuals that have become Freemasons over the years that just they're just not into those aspects of it. You know, it's Freemasonry over the last, let's say, 60 years since 1950, maybe like 70 years. It is definitely in continental American Freemasonry taken a much more social aspect. So the individuals that are coming to it, and I don't think I'm the only one that would say this, are definitely enjoying it more for the social entertainments that it brings rather than a religion of not being religion philosophy school. So that's the difference. So you get different individuals coming to it. You have more opportunities for different things to do. I hate to say a general disinterest in it, but some of it could be a little bit tedious. And then just an understanding. So one of the great laments is that we today lack the language skills of generations ago, in particular back when, so let's say in the decades following when Pike put out Morals and Dogma, that we just don't have the foundations of language and of philosophy and of rhetoric and the other liberal arts to understand things in the way that we would have when a lot of these things were written. So maybe in one hand, the problem is that a lot of this esoteric thought in Masonry is written and codified in languages from times way back that we just don't have the vernacular for, or that we're just lazy and don't want to spend the time to try to get up to speed. But, you know, I would say my Latin skill is nil. So when a Latin phrase is used in something that it's, I have to look it up. Or if a particular deity is mentioned or a parallel drawn with it, I didn't learn that in school, so I've got to look that up. If a philosopher is mentioned, you know, thank God for Wikipedia. Let me pull that one up. You know what I mean? So just by the nature of our progression in education, not to say that our education now is terrible. I mean, it's certainly lacking, but you know, how important is it to know Latin today? How important is it to really understand the depths of the philosophers? I mean, obviously it's important, but who's read Plato's Republic? I probably haven't looked at it in quite a long time. I have a book with it in here. If I need to read it, I can pull it off the shelf if somebody makes a, you know, vague reference to it. But is it, you know, does it dictate the day to day? I think that's why a lot of these things have become less understood, less researched, less studied in a regular sense. The long and the short is that it's a lot of work.
Well, that and everybody has Netflix, man. Come on.
Right? I mean, you're spot on, or video games or app games or even just Twitter or Facebook. If there is a way to devise, you know, I joked about flashcards, but you certainly couldn't gamify Freemasonry because it would lose something. And that might be what some of the uniqueness of it is, or one of its, you know, virtues and sell points is that it's not those things. But right now, those things are like the cat's meow. You know, it's funny that you mentioned it. I mean, I watched a video last night on not Netflix, but, you know, a parallel to it with Amazon. I mean, yeah, that's what I did. I didn't crack open Morals and Dogma. I didn't, you know, invoke any dark arts or draw any salt circles to summon a demon. No, I watched a documentary about love in Japan.
There you go.
what I mean?
Yeah, I was reading through your stuff in preparation for this, but you know, at about 11:30 or 12 o'clock at night, I turned on Netflix. I watched Glow, which is about women's wrestling. Highly recommend it.
Oh, my God.
But anyways.
You're probably I think you told me yesterday how old you were, but I sadly enough remember watching Glow when it was actually on TV.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was born in 83, and it was on in the 80s, so I missed the Glow heyday, but I'm well aware. I'm a wrestling fan, so I'm well aware of what Glow is and its role in the history of professional wrestling. So when I saw they were making a show about it, I got super psyched. And
thanks for telling me that it's on there. Now I know I'll be watching tonight.
Do it, man. Yeah, go check it out. It's well worth it so far. But I think you hit on something. You know, I think the money to me right now is if you wanted to teach somebody occult symbols, is to make an app game out of it. You do see that there is, you know, things like Assassin's Creed or my gaming knowledge has severely went downhill the past few years, but there are things that do touch on these kind of lost arts that we're talking about, Hermeticism and the occult and the symbology behind it. And you see them everywhere too in pop culture. It's just nobody knows what they mean and no one knows where they came from. So because
which
of Netflix.
Which maybe is a good thing. Maybe it's that hint of something that would interest somebody to look more into it. And I think that's the importance of a lot of these. That's the importance of a lot of these practices continuing on to exist and continuing to be published and just existing. So it could certainly appear in games or in movies, you know, if it's done well. I don't know what a better way of doing it would be. You know what I mean? So with one of the resurgences of Masonry in recent years was the movie National Treasure or even Dan Brown's books.
Yeah.
You know, I may be more overt and glitterized, but all the same, it's a pathway into the knowledge of something and certainly opened the door. I would say and as ironic as it might sound, the National Treasure phenomenon was this weird, unforeseen hit of juice that goosed the fraternity at just the right time with the interest in the regular world. You know, unintentional, totally organic, and sure, a lot of people went to lodges saying, you know, where's the treasure? How do I become part of it? But, you know, of the 100 people that might knock on a door, one or two of them would be genuinely interested in it, realizing that it was just a hokum movie and let me find out more about this. So I don't know what that answer is. A game maybe. I've thought about these things and, you know, pondered what the possibilities were. I think that there are some movies that come out that do very much lean into that. I couldn't tell you offhand. I know when I see them in what I think and movie wise that, that really functions at that level. But even one movie in particular, and it's horrible, but was a strangely succinct movie in the sense of understanding it. It was a European film or French film, but As Above, So Below.
Oh yeah, it was like a horror film.
It was a but underneath this the juicy horrorness of it was this idea of moving between states and moving from above to below, and you know what I mean. So again, the mechanisms are kind of weird and kind of silly, but when you take the whole thing, I remember watching it. I remember I avoided watching it in the movie, thinking, "Oh, how stupid! How dare they use this phrase? What's with their lobby cards, the movie posters with it, with the upside down Eiffel Tower? How dumb!" And then I caught it on one of the channels, Netflix or Amazon or one such, and was like really blown away by it. Like, you know, once you get through the horrorness of it, this has kind of got a pretty cool display or a pretty cool representation of what some of these ideas are.
Yeah, I watched it too, not expecting much, because I think it was on Netflix, and this was before Netflix changed their rating system, and it told you the star rating, like, based on what you would think of it, based on your other things that you've rated, and it was like a 1 or 2 star movie. But I was like, well, the title is fucking intriguing, man. Like, I have to watch this movie. It takes place in the catacombs of Paris, right? If I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I find that area, the catacombs, to be pretty fascinating. I've come across some stories about that just reading about the occult, but I don't think the storyline was particularly good, you know? Like, the movie wasn't particularly good, but the things that it communicated and showed, like you said, beyond that, were actually pretty, I don't want to say spot on, but, you know, they communicated.
Weirdly profound, right?
Yeah, like, absolutely.
They somehow figured that out in the overall of it. You're right, because the acting wasn't terrible. The effects weren't bad. The story, okay, we'll pick the right one. I mean, it had a touch of Indiana Jones and National Treasure to it, but yeah, the theme, the overall theme. And so maybe that's what this forward communication of a lot of these things are, that we'll see. It won't be overt. It won't beat you over the head with, you know, this is this because of that. It's the themes. It's the philosophies of these things, which, yeah. I mean, are at work in most everything. You know, I mean,
once you start to learn about, you know, we're talking about symbols here, or we started talking about symbols. Once you start to learn the symbols and what they mean, you see them in a lot of different places that you've always looked at but never seen them before, you know? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Oh, man. And once you start down that rabbit hole, it's almost hard to not. And at a certain point, you start questioning your own sanity as to what you're seeing. It's like, is this that? Am I really seeing this? Does it mean that? You know what I mean? But you see that everywhere. It's almost in the same way of, like, you know, when you buy a particular car and a particular color of that car, and all of a sudden you start seeing that car everywhere. You know, and it's a dangerous road, because you do start to question whether or not the things that you're seeing are in fact those things, or is it just something else? You know what I mean? Am I seeing squares and compasses in this stuff, or am I just imagining that I am? Am I wanting to see it and I'm seeing it?
Well, I think there's something to the power of the mind and creating that reality, wanting to see it and then it manifesting. But I also think it's a bit of a split between that and it's just already there, you know, that there are people that consciously put them into their work.
Absolutely.
So speaking of symbols, I want to stay on this conversation just for a moment, because I want to talk about Solomon's Temple. I think before we get into some details about it, if you could briefly explain what the temple is and the role that it plays in Freemasonry.
I can do that. So essentially, Solomon's Temple is the temple from the Old Testament, First Kings, I think, constructed by Solomon, son of David, who won the right to the territory. I'm probably butchering this as a history, but essentially it was constructed. Within Masonic parlance, it was constructed with a number of workmen overseen by King Hiram and King Solomon, with the master builder Hiram Abiff. And the symbolic function or structure of it within Freemasonry is that the temple, the mason himself, so the individual going through the degrees and everybody in the room all represent these builders of the temple. The temple itself has a particular significance to it in the sense that it exists and functions in this particular way, but it's also allegorical or representational of this inner building of oneself. So what, you know, in one hand, you're a physical builder acting or in the role of in a Masonic lodge of this builder. So you're pretending. It's a word I don't want to use, but is what you're doing. Not pretending, but you're basically, that's the understanding. So in a philosophical sense, obviously we're not building this literal temple. We are building the spiritual temple within us. So as we start to unpack this idea of Solomon's temple, Solomon's temple was constructed originally in order to house the Ten Commandments. So in the Ark, at the holiest of holies, the most inner sanctum where the only person who could go in was the high priest. It was literally the house of God because it was believed that the divine, not in some magic-y way, lived inside these Ten Commandments, but as Christ was this manifestation of God above, the Ten Commandments also were this manifestation of the will of God to the people as it was given to Moses on the Mount Sinai, and these commandments put into this ark, carried around for a long time, housed in these impermanent temples as they spent their time in the desert, and finally put into this temple. So in the Masonic sense, obviously, we're not literally building this temple. So in some sense, we are constructing this inner temple, which is housing, and this is open to interpretation, but this is perhaps a good way of seeing it. We are constructing this inner temple to house this inner divine, which again goes back to these Hermetic ideas and these ideas of the nature of the divine, of the supreme being, you know, outside the context of Judeo-Christianity, but in this, and I hate to keep belaboring it, but this Hermetic idea of man as being divine creator, created in the image of God, and constructing this inner temple. And so out of this construction of this inner temple, there's particular rites and rituals that take place within Freemasonry, which I won't get into, that I'm sure you could find online, but have certain aspects to do with the secrets of Freemasonry in the sense of inheriting this role and then manifesting this masterness. So becoming a master mason is a process that takes place in the temple as the master builder, and its conclusion is what you could say is sort of the last nail in the box of this construction of the individual, the last chip of the stone. All an allegory, all story, but again, which takes place in this imaginary allegorical temple, in this imaginary allegorical lodge of master masons who were building the temple within the system of Freemasonry. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great explanation. And I think it's important to note here too that Agrippa wrote in his three books of occult philosophy that the universe was divided into three worlds or maybe three degrees, which parallels the path of the Master Mason. And those three worlds consisted of an elemental world, a celestial world, and an intellectual world. And each world received influences from the world above it. So I was wondering if you could maybe just briefly flesh out, you know, what these three worlds consist of.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So if memory serves, that was, I think I put that back in the early book of the Masonic Traveler book. And so in this idea, and this is something that I've been exploring in the more recent books. So in The Apprentice, The Fellow of the Craft, and The Master Mason, which is coming, that these states of being are, if first in one hand, progressions into this Kabbalistic tree of life. So we'll go back to that parallel. From the material world, moving up into the celestial heaven. So in the books that I'm just referenced, The Apprentice and Fellow of the Craft, they are the beginning steps from Malkuth into Tav, going into Yasod. And the idea is that it's this climb, this starting at the foundation, this elevation into the heavens, and then the next step of Yasod, which I won't go into until the book's out, but moving into this philosophical space of a vastly expanding universe. So at the very bottom, we start in this place of chaos, and in my writing. So in the first book in that series, it's the series of the Symbolic Lodge, that what I talked about. And this parallels with Agrippa. Ironically, you know, in writing, I think that I just internalized a lot of this and didn't use it as direct reference. But obviously those not going through this system, not to say that they're right or wrong in their existence and how they operate, but when you come to the door of Freemasonry, you exist in this world of chaos. So, and by chaos, I don't mean, you know, hell kind of chaos. There's no crying and gnashing of teeth necessarily. It's not pain. It's not this. It's just more the philosophical idea of chaos, of just the movement of gears and the grinding of life and the not stopping to smell the rosiness of existence. And it's at the point that the decision is made to join not just Freemasonry, but any system of esoteric study as a group or even on your own practice. It's a coming to a door. It's a decision to move up through this system into those higher spheres. So starting out at the firmament, you're through the chaos, to use a Darwinian ideas, we crawl out from the chaos under the land into this foundational world. So you begin as a babe in the woods of this idea, but now stopping to become a part of it. Once that process is complete, you then move into the next, and you move into this elemental world of trying to understand, of the broadening of the mind to this understanding as a fellow craft, the association of others who have gone on this path as well. So it's another step in the initiation, and then to move into these celestial apartments above. So moving up further into these spheres, philosophical spheres, within the Symbolic Lodge and walking the final steps into the Sanctum Sanctorum, into the presence of the Ark and those tablets, you know, and one of my notions of this, you know, and all the symbolism of it, essentially the Holy of Holies is a room. There's no windows. The only way in is through a curtain or through a door, and no one else is allowed in or can see it, because the only person allowed in is the high priest. But in this process of doing this and philosophically understanding and trying to interpret it, obviously with Pike and his further degrees up to the 32nd and 33rd, there's a system beyond it. So maybe in some scientific-y sense or just in a more of a metaphorical sense, there is a transitionary threshold that has to be crossed in order to go beyond that into these further celestial apartments of degrees. And that's what I think in the way back writings of Agrippa, as he was starting to write about these spheres and the evolutions of the Christian or Western Kabbalah in trying to interpret these things and smash them together to see if they would stick or to reconglomerate them into these new configurations, that is what's at the heart of these systems, that in Freemasonry in particular, in the really deepest recesses of what it means to become a Freemason, for what it means to take the teachings to heart. Now, you can very easily just superficially go your way through it and say, okay, yeah, that's what it means. Let's see what's on TV, and disregard it all. But this goes back to what you said earlier about how deeply you study Masonry. Now, maybe I've overstudied it and blown a fuse in my head, but it seems to me that these systems, as they evolve, as you start to associate the writings of Pike, that it is this progression up at the early level through these 3 degrees. But then as you surpass that, you start going from the Symbolic Lodge into the Lodge of Perfection, into the Rosicrucian parallels. And then as you start going up into the Consistory, that, like, I want to say that in some of the early sketchings that I've done in trying to understand these degrees, as, let's say, you draw the 10 sephira of the Tree of Life, at certain intervals, there's like bubbles that exist under it. And it's through those bubbles that you start to enter into different spheres of thought, which take you into these deeper Agrippa climates. So it's this micro and this macro understanding. It's this as above, so below, which gets overused. The parallel is that what you see at the bottom mirrors the top, but you don't see it until you get to the top. And it doesn't make a lot of sense until you start to understand it in the sense of moving through it. And you reach those levels to look back and say, okay, so I'm in the same position that I started in, which isn't a bad thing. But you know, what's happened is that there's been a spiritual growth where, sure, you're probably standing in near the same positions that you started in with it, but your understanding of these things is vastly different. So what may have looked as a flat plane before is now curved, or, you know, what may have looked dull and dingy is now rich and glittery. I mean, these are just sort of like, you know, philosophical navel gazing in some of the understandings, but I mean, these do go to direct interpretations of how we evolve as people. You know, we don't have the same opinions that we had in the past. And so, you know, is that an occult growth or is that just progression? Which is something that Freemasonry teaches in this Velocroft degree, the sense of going through these stages of maturity. So, you know, in the macro or the micro or the macro, it's small and it's large, and it's this continuum of progression.
I think it's a bit of both. It is, I think, occult growth. And I think by occult, I actually mean spiritual. I also think the word occult is overused and it's misinterpreted too. And I think that's just what we're talking about. It's spiritual growth. It's progression. It's all of the above. And just to tie up the conversation about Solomon's Temple, you have a quote from Dame Frances Yates. She suggested that Solomon's Temple represented a definition of sacred geometry that was mirrored in the temple by reflecting a perfect and proportional measure made in accordance with the unalterable laws of cosmic geometry. I have to ask you, Greg, what the hell does that mean?
Well, you're not a high enough degree yet to understand that, so I couldn't tell you. So Yates was, some of her work's been questioned, but only because it was when it was written. So a lot of the conclusions that she made at the time in her books, the core of her conclusions are sort of questions because of either her philosophical leanings at the time or just, you know, maybe she was just over blathering about things and not quite being concise or not interpreting it in with these other things in mind. I would say in just looking at this pull quote, at the time that a lot of Freemasonry was codified and Solomon's Temple was woven into it, ideas of sacred geometry, of the 47th problem of Euclid and Euclid himself, geometry was looked at as sort of this religionized or the sacred math of proportion and volume and space. And I mean, the tools, if you look at the tools themselves of Freemasonry, a square and a compass, so you're drawing circles and you're drawing right angles. I mean, that's the basis of geometry was, maybe over religionized. And I want to say that that's probably what it is that she's trying to say in this. And so then with Solomon's Temple, so if you go into the books of the Bible, it gets into the specifics of its size and its construct and the elements that have gone into it and the proportions therein. And it's almost a glamorization or a idealization of what perfect proportion is or what would be a right and true measure. I mean, I'm kind of just shooting in the dark here. And what do you think? And tell me what your thoughts are to it. And let's see if that helps pull anything out of my peanut.
Well, that quote was over my head. That's why I asked you what the hell it meant. Because I tried to make sense of it so I could form a better question around it. Because I wanted to segue that into a talk about, you know, the role that geometry or sacred geometry plays in Masonic philosophy. But I didn't know how to get there. And this quote I thought was a good gateway to that, but I don't know what she meant. That's the thing. I just have no idea.
It probably is. So let's go, I mean, to the passage itself. So what I wrote in here with the pull quote with this. So it says in Frances Yates' text, The Occult Philosophy of the Elizabethan Age, a book she wrote, suggests that the early Renaissance Kabbalists felt that the temple represented a definition of sacred geometry that was mirrored in the temple by reflecting a perfect and proportional measure made in accordance with the unalterable laws of the cosmic geometry. So if memory serves, in what this is saying is in a sense that the fetishization of the Solomon's Temple with those Renaissance Kabbalists created this construct of what they felt perfection was within these geometric and mathematical constructs of space and size and parallels into the apartments of the heavens, if you will, in the sense of space and design. I mean, it's very much a romanticized ideal of what this geometry is. Further in the quote, it pulls into the Vitruvian principles. So Vitruvius, who with his orders of architecture was a maybe mid-period Roman architect, a sense who codified for the Romans what the perfection, the quote unquote perfection was of Roman architecture, in the sense of what worked, how you put fountains in, what directions you face the fountains. In particular with Vitruvius, the orders of architecture within Freemasonry, and Freemasons will key into this because they'll understand what that means. But the orders of architecture were adopted based on the Vitruvian orders of architecture. So the orders of architecture of Vitruvius, it goes from the types of pillars. So Tuscan, Doric,
I think it's Ionic.
Ionic, thank you. Yeah, it's really in the day. All the way up to Corinthian. So it's these, and then composite. But I mean, these are sort of like our history terms that we look at today as just sort of being things that we throw around. But in these early writings and adopting these ideals of proportion and size, even back to Roman temples and Greek temples being constructed facing east and to these divine proportions, that's where I think that I was going with that quote. And so to your question about geometry, is geometry really a factor in the Masonic Lodge? And to be frank, the honest is no. There is parallels with the idea of geometry, the letter G being in particular, this ideal of perfection. And I would say that you could make the argument that it has to do with just the preciseness of geometry. But obviously there are mathematics that take more into account these aspects of either perfection or of more dynamic measure with calculus or trigonometry, but geometry coming back to the spatial measure, this exactness of the measures themselves, you know, hence the parallels with the universe. And these get tossed in with this idea of the Masonic letter G, you know, which is parallel with God and geometry. And that's where these different things get smooshed together, crafting this notion of geometry and Freemasonry.
That G is open, or is subject of much debate. You know, I don't know if Freemasons actually really sit around and talk about what the G stands for, but it seems like all the non-Freemasons do. And I think, you know, you just kind of squash that it stands for geometry. We've also heard that it stands for God, but if I was a betting man, Greg, and I am a betting man, so I would put my money on the G actually standing for Gnosis, just because of the... Hey, hold on, let me...
Go ahead, make your argument. I am reaching over to my library of books that I've kept here and pulling one out for you to...
Well, my only argument here is that we do find traces of Gnostic thought in Freemasonry, this Gnostic idea of Sophia, of knowledge, of Gnosis, you know, playing a role in Freemasonry, this the ultimate enlightenment of the self. It just seemed like if that G stood for anything that wasn't God or wasn't geometry, which I think is too obvious, I would bet that it stands for Gnosis, because that is the ultimate, I think, goal of Freemasonry.
It could be, but so... Gnosis capital G or Gnosis lowercase g? So Gnosis knowledge or Gnosis early Christian church Gnostic?
Gnosis capital G knowledge.
It could be. Who am I to say? Who am I to say? So here is something that I will say about it. There is no hard and fast rule book as to what is or what is not exactitude and Masonic symbolism. So in some iterations of Masonry, the G is dropped altogether from the inside of the square and compass. It may or may not be displayed over the east of a lodge. In some of those iterations within the square and compass, the Yod, the Jewish letter Yod, the little squiggle, you can Google it and see it, It is there instead, which is, you know, part of the tetragrammaton of this representation of God. In others, there's a star, a five-pointed star. In other iterations, there's no G, there's no Yod, there's no star. It's a all-seeing eye. As much as I hate to say that it's open to interpretation, I think that the letter G in the center of the square and compass is a design decision that was made at some point, not to be vague and miscommunicative, but to encompass as many meanings as possible, within that very small space to try to either appease or appeal to as many people as it can. So the book that I was pulling is actually a very small book, and you could probably find it online somewhere. It's a Paul Foster case book. Let me see when it was written, and you can see if you could find it. I do not believe that it's online because it goes back and it's probably still under subject of copyright. I'm looking at one published in 1981, but it goes back further than that. It's called The Masonic Letter G. And it's an exploration by Paul Foster Case, one of the individuals that I think we connected earlier to the Kabbalion. And it's very early days. This is done much later. So we'll just skip right to the back. All right, or let's start. I'll just start a little bit at the front. And just in this little book that he wrote, he writes, "It is difficult to determine when the letter G was introduced into speculative Freemasonry as a symbol. Mackey's Encyclopedia of Freemasonry says this letter is not derived from the operative Masons of the Middle Ages and formed no part of the architectural decorations of old cathedrals." He goes on, he brings up Rosicrucians and Kabbalists. It's second paragraph. He says, "The Masonic meaning of the letter G never has been esoteric. The whole world has been told that the symbol owes its prominence to the fact that G is the initial of geometry. This makes it a symbolic summary of the entire Masonic system." Which may be. And so we skip to the end, and I won't give away the conclusion of it, but he says that it ties into, let's see, letter G corresponds to the value of 3, but in English G is a 7th letter. Thus it represents the triple force and the 7 stages of a sublimation. Hence it corresponds also to the digits of 73, signifying chokma, wisdom developed from the seed kash, trust, and constituting guamal, the recompense which is the master's wage of those who travel east on the camel, gimel of earnest endeavor. But this is Case, and Case evolved his own system of esoteric teaching through Builders of the Adytum, using tarot and numerology. Not to say that what he's writing is incorrect, but that perhaps goes to show the vagueness as to what exactly that letter means, and just sort of the institutional assumptions of certain meanings and just holding true to particular aspects. It's way easier to say that the G represents God than to get into what the varieties of that God or that G mean. Does that make sense? So I think in mm-hmm. one hand, it's very easy to step back and say, okay, yeah, that's what it means. It's God or geometry. Well, maybe God is geometry. Maybe that's what they mean. Well, maybe it's just geometry, or maybe it's gnosis. It may be, but maybe that's trying to over-intellectualize something at a much more simplistic level than at some point to just sort of mean that it's this sort of sublime divine idea that's encapsulated within this very angular square and this circumscribing compass, which are both aspects of Freemasonry that have to do, I think, with this broader hermetic idea of moving from the firmament into the heavens. So you're moving geometrically from this very square 90 degrees into this very round compass.
Yeah, but you're also moving closer to Gnosis, Greg.
Well, absolutely. But in that process, that's what you're gaining. So I don't disagree with you. It is way open to interpretation. Personally, I am not a fan of the G in there just because it does create such a specific meaning at the onset rather than it having more of the vague speculation. So better to have nothing in there and let it be open to interpretation rather than try to pigeonhole it into a very particular way of thinking about it. By putting the letter there, it's like you can have no other idea of what that means in that space than by what you see. So if you don't see anything, then maybe that's a better way of understanding it.
I would agree. I like that it is open to interpretation either way, whether it's there or not. So, you know, somewhere in this conversation, we mentioned the three pillars, and you have a good section in the Masonic Traveler book about the three pillars and what they represent. So they do represent directions, you know, south, west, and east. And I was curious why north was not represented in there. You say that north in Masonic tradition is considered a place of darkness. Why is that?
Well, without getting too deep into the ritual, just for the secrets, as it were, I mean, just in thinking about the transit of the sun. So just in the transit of the sun hits the east, obviously, in the morning, the west in the evening, and the south through the better part of the day. But depending upon where you are on the globe, the north, obviously, is not illuminated. I mean, I don't want to get too deep. So as we start to look at the pillars themselves, I mean, obviously, it's three pillars. So if we're looking at a Kabbalistic system, it's three, not four. And so, you know, maybe that's a syncretic omission, that they omitted it because there's not a fourth aspect. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that I've dissected it enough to have a firm enough understanding. So, or at least to have a informed enough opinion of it. I could say for in particular within the Masonic degrees, there are references as to the North Gate, but you know, I don't want to go too deeply into that just because there are particular aspects of the secrecy involved with that.
That's totally
maybe one day you'll find out.
Maybe one day I will. So I did have a really kind of trippy thought while reading this section about the pillars that I wanted to share with you just real quick. You said that the East is seen as the birthplace of knowledge, of life, and of death. The East, of course, is also where the sun rises each day. We all know that. And this got me thinking about lifetimes and past lives and reincarnation and things like that. I've always felt personally drawn to the East from a cultural perspective, and I've thought many times that perhaps I lived a past life in the East, maybe. And then I thought about how I live in the West now. I'm in the U.S., and you know, so are you, and that got me thinking about the pattern of the sun, you know, rising in the East and setting in the West, and how that may be a metaphor for the pattern of the soul or the spirit as it incarnates in physical form. I've been told many times that I have an old soul, whatever that actually means. So all this considered, my rather trippy conclusion was that I personally am near the end of my physical existence, both literally and metaphorically. My sun is setting in the West where I currently live. As someone who is far more knowledgeable in the metaphysical, do you think I'm onto something here with this thought, or am I completely off base, and do I just feel drawn to the East because I do seek this sort of esoteric knowledge?
Let me say first, I don't know if I'm in a position to say if you're right or wrong. I don't think anybody is. You know, that sort of harkens to the personal journey thing. What I will say is, in finding parallels with things that I've either gone through or found to be truer in the sense of the East, is that there seems to be, and I hate to say that this may be just my own fetishisms of these Eastern thoughts, but there seems to be I hate to use the word pure because, again, that's so patronymous of me, or no, I don't know what the word is, but the notions that come out of Eastern philosophies are a more recent development. And Manly Hall writes about them and seems to fetishize them, and as do others. But as these have come in, I think that we find a greater resonance with them in the sense of our spiritual unfolding. Two books one book, but they're really split in two, is Raja Yoga, which is a Eastern philosophy. It's a form. It's one of the branches of yoga, and it kind of gets a little trippy dippy at the end, but it really speaks to some of these cores and some of these, philosophies. And then, Yogananda, the teachings of Yogananda, I think the self-realization of the self, a biography out there that I've been trying to get through. It's very different thought than Western thought. So to your question of is what you're thinking correct? Who's to say? I mean, it depends on what you follow philosophically in the sense of tradition or of faith, of what you even see as like reincarnation or going to heaven or things like that. So your cosmology, of how the universe functions, who's to say? I mean, I think you could certainly be an old soul or in Rosicrucian terms, even a reincarnated soul or probably more Hinduism and Eastern philosophy. certainly is as souls travel through the universe. Whether or not we know it, who knows? Amork does some interesting work in trying to scry to find these past lives, but certainly any sort of meditative practice could produce the same results of perhaps seeing these other things, these past lives. So maybe in what you're sensing is, and this, you know, I don't want to sound like some prognosticative hoodoo guru, but it could just be the interest in these things evolving and tapping into that subconscious connection that you have to these things that may or may not be at the end, because saying that there's an end means that there's a definitive beginning. And I don't know if I'm willing to say that there's a definitive beginning or end. Yes, there's a beginning of end of time, Big Bang to now, but even before that, what existed? So can we say that there's a definitive timeline? You know, this goes to the whole thing of matter ceasing to exist. Does matter cease to exist, or does it become a different energy source, or does it become something else? I don't know if there's a distinct beginning, middle, or end. There's progression, there's time, there's regression, and there's a whole big, you know, circle of life, if you will. I mean, it just, the process keeps on going. Whether or not the consciousness that's existing and talking to me now is Ryan in this podcast is at a beginning or end is neither here nor there. I think it's just the state of being aware you're at right now. You know, and this goes to the whole mindfulness of being in the moment rather than worrying about the future or fretting at what happened in the past, you know, which I think it has validity in the sense of trying to improve oneself, you know, because if you're stuck worrying about what came before or worrying about the future, and it's easy to say because I do that, you know, I worry about what the future holds in one way or another. But those things are sort of out of your hands. And I think that's where it comes back to the effort and work of what you're doing in order to create and to manifest, pulling these hermetic ideas of being one of the divine's craftsmen making things. I definitely subscribe to that rather than trying to think of things as either coming from source or going to source. What is source? Source is just a bus terminal in between another source, which is another terminal in between another one. So I don't know. I mean, am I answering you? And I appreciate your saying, am I complimenting me on the esoteric knowledge? I've read a lot of books and, you know, I would by no means say that I'm, you know, a guru like that. It just seems to me that there are certain realities at play that are outside of what we're told as the norm. And I don't mean like hokum stuff, aliens and this and that, or, you know, spirit, just that there are greater philosophical or spiritual energies at work that may not be contributors to the day-to-day functionings, but certainly exist at some meta level to either influence or just shape the world around us.
I guess I was just trying to get to the source of my fetish for Asian food. I don't know, man.
It's the egg rolls, dude. It's a philosophy.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it is, man. It is.
I would recommend Indian food. I don't know if you're a fan of Indian food.
I am. Yeah, I've been eating. You know, it's funny. I've been eating a lot of Indian food recently, to be honest. I have this. I don't want to say it's great because it's like an $8 lunch buffet, but there's a place near where I work, and I've been going to lunch there quite a bit actually. But anyways, so let's get back to some more philosophical discussion here. There are 32 degrees in the Scottish Rite. We've talked about this. We talked about this early in the conversation. The 33rd degree that you hear so much about is one that can't be earned. It's sort of honorary from my understanding. I've also read that when it comes to esoteric Freemasonry, that there may be degrees above 33. Is there any truth to that?
Oh, man. Within what is considered mainstream Freemasonry? No. There's a branch, it escapes me right now as to what it is, and it might be under Memphis Miserium. I think it's under that Cagliostro Memphis Miserium that it goes up to 360 degrees, which, I mean, has its own interesting philosophical conundrums to it. But could you imagine trying to attain 360 degrees? They would just start conferring degrees, you know, in the tens or hundreds at a time. Okay, here you get degree 250 to 300 today. So within Masonry, I don't, I've heard, and this is anecdotal, but I've heard that in the past when the Scottish Rite rolled out its degrees, the ideal was, and that I heard that this happens still in some places in South America, that the degrees would be given one per year. So as an individual, you would progress one degree a year after you've had that year to either understand it fully and come up with some, they call it a piece of architecture that explains your understanding of that particular degree. So the first degree is 1 year, second degree, third degree. So at the end, you have literally spent 32 years, which is why there weren't a lot of 32 degree Masons. Scottish Rite in America has changed that they don't do that anymore. Now they confer degrees in chunks, understandably so, because it's just so much and it's hard in a time and age where there's just not the attention span for that. Could you imagine taking 32 years to try to go through something? I mean, you said you're mid 30s or so now, I think. Could you imagine by the time you were mid 60s that you were finishing it? I couldn't tell you what I'm doing in 10 years, let alone to say that I'm still going after this in 30 years.
I think if you look at it like, if you don't look at it like a task, you know, if you don't look at it like it's a job to do this, then I think if you approach it with, you know, the mindset that, you know, for the next 32 years of my life, I'm going to strive to be a better version of me than I was the year before. I think that mindset with that approach, it makes it more achievable to me. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to be looking ahead, you know, to the future. It just means that I'm going to take this time right now to just be better day after day after day. And then, you know, year after year after year. And by the time I'm, you know, I'm 33. So by the time I'm 65, you know, maybe I will have learned something by then. That's how I would look at it.
Well, and certainly I think that you're absolutely right. And that's probably the mechanisms that are at work within Freemasonry in the sense of a continued, you know, a daily progression of knowledge under the fraternity. Same thing with Judeo-Christianity of studying the Bible every day or studying the Talmud every day or Islam and studying the Quran a little bit every day. And I mean, I think that those are the underpinnings behind any philosophical, religious or spiritual system is that it does take that time. But I mean, in the context of your question, in the sense of these additional degrees and the further down the line that you get, I mean, there's just not enough time in the day to try to absorb it all over this long extended period of time. I mean, on Twitter the other day, I was just sort of fishing just to sort of build out memory for me of all these different orders and systems. And I want to say that systems like Freemasonry, I think that I came down to 9 or 10 different that are of similar stature and age and composition. And if you were to spend your time in 5 of those, that could easily be a lifetime. You know, I mean, you could study bits and pieces here or there, or try to assimilate different aspects of all of them. And just try to have an understanding, but it's a tremendous amount of effort. You know, it'd be one thing if we were monks or nuns cloistered in a convent somewhere or an abbey, and that's all we did is sat and studied this stuff. But we're not. We live life, and so it is very hard to try to have a complete and comprehensive understanding. Even scholars, I think it would be impossible to have this grand unified theory of all of these and try to put them in some encyclopedic book to say this is what this means, this is what this guy said, this is what that guy said, this is how it relates. And at the end of the day, I don't know if it would be worth it because, I mean, cross-sectionally, a lot of these things seem to all say the same thing. And just parallel one another. You know, it, as silly as it sounds, all roads lead to Rome. Well, in this sense, they kind of do. There are some tangents. I mean, you could start going out in some wild rides. Crawley and Thelema with OTO, and I don't make these parallels for people to say, see, he's connected them. But things like Anton LaVey's Satanism or Spencer's Rosicrucianism or Paul Foster Case's Boda, they all sort of branch out, but they all have fingers back into these four systems. So I don't know about Satanism. That'd be an interesting study. But even like religious systems, you know, so Mormonism having these connections back to Freemasonry. You could spend the time in any of these systems studying them, trying to find parallels or just grow more deeply in them and never step out of that box. which is entirely possible. But I, you know, if you were to add additional degrees to the systems, or even if you were to try to undertake them, it would be astronomical. You know, there was a running joke with folks who go to Lodge. I'm not too keyed into that much at all anymore. But the running joke was for some that they could go to a different dinner every night of the week for different lodges or different groups within Freemasonry that they had association with. So, I mean, you could be so involved in these things that, you know, one would question whether or not you're getting anything out of them because you're so involved, because you're going to different meetings or different groups, or you know what I mean? You're going to Blue Lodge, you're going to York Rite, you're going to Scottish Rite, you're going to Shrine, you're going to the Jester's meetings, or you know what I mean? There's all these different groups that you could go out and do things with that at a certain point, there's just no more space for input. There's no way to interpret any of them, that they all just sort of become this association. So this idea of there being, you know, lots and lots of degrees, I mean, maybe the person who's got a 360th degree knows something more than I do, but you know, or in some systems, so like in I want to say it's OTO, maybe some of the higher degrees are just degrees you can't get while you live, that you evolve into it, you know, as you pass and you become this higher thing or higher power. What was it? Scientology with L. Ron Hubbard, that mm-hmm. at the high, you don't die. You just transmute into this next state of being, a quote unquote degree, and go on with your spiritual studies at that level. So more doesn't necessarily constitute better, I think. So maybe there are more degrees, but in mainstream Freemasonry, there isn't. To the best of my knowledge, and if there is, I've never been invited or asked to it.
Oh, man. Before we get out of here, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this. It seems that there's been a bit of a hit job on Freemasonry, at least from my perspective, because, you know, we brought up the church earlier and the Inquisition and you know, that sort of stamping out of these Hermetic principles. But, you know, beyond that, I know that in conspiracy circles, that Freemasons have been cast as villains, you know, sort of hell-bent on world domination and, you know, shit like that. And there seems to be no distinction between them and other groups like the Bavarian Illuminati or the Rosicrucians or any other esoteric group, really. But I was wondering how you address people who see Freemasonry as nefarious.
I think that we look, as a society, as a culture, we look for boogeymen in places, and where we want to see them, we'll see them. Whether or not we have inputs from other places, we will see what we want to see. I don't know if I would go so far as saying that it's a hit job like that, as much as it is individuals looking for villains in theaters that of their construction to be the foils to whatever other plans that they're seeing, which is a really vague way of answering this. I don't know. I mean, I think that the Illuminati has been, and maybe rightly so, because even some prominent Masons way back, George Washington denounced the Illuminati, but the Illuminati had an interesting, its core was a very interesting idea of unification, something that is happening maybe more so now than at the time, to overthrow monarchs and papacies and have governments of the people unified to help the people. But instead it's taken as, you know, this group who is looking for world control and to usher in world domination, to control people. And so those ideas have evolved and taken heart with things like Bohemian Grove or the Bilderbergers. And I am in no position to argue the merits or dismerits of any of those things with individuals who see those as sacred cows. I mean, that, you know, you might as well try to convince a wall that it's a walkway than try to convince some of these conspiracy folks. But I will say that I have had conversations with people who have been open to these things and evolved their thinking to them and looked at them in a different light. But I mean, you might as well tell a leopard to change its spots for trying to convince folks of some of this stuff. And so why they villainize them? I think because they need the boogeyman villain to point to as the foil to whatever virtuous thing that they think that they're foiling. So whether or not it's from the foundation of the church, pushing these agendas or people just looking for saying who's covering up aliens or who's doing horrible things to children. I think people just look to a group that, oh, one thing I will add is that Freemasonry itself is not very keen or interested in trying to fight these individuals, so they won't dispute them openly and aggressively. Whereas, say, like, you know, the reports of Scientology suing everybody who ever says anything disparagingly about them, Freemasonry has no interest or will to do that for a variety of reasons behind the scenes, but it just won't. And so these people can come out and say the most heinous things. They'll point to the most minuscule of things, you know, something like P2 Lodge and how they were tied to the mafia. And so all of them must be tied to the mafia. Or Albert Pike, you know, wrote about World War III and these things. There are very few people that will come out and fight and dispute those aggressively. And so I think that that's why people continuously go back to the well, to the boogeyman Freemasons who don't, nobody stands up to fight them on it. And the ones that do are very superficial and small, not small in their caliber, but just small in the sense of the greater noise of the people who are making the accusations. You know, it's one thing for me or someone else. There's a fellow that's on Twitter who in my feed, I constantly see him refuting some of the crazy things that people say about Freemasonry. If you have Hootsuite, just put in Freemasonry as a follow keyword and just look at some of the asinine things that people post about it. And to no audiences, they're probably bots or just other jagoffs who are just posting up things to be controversial, you know, in Pizzagate format. But this one guy, he is like on the daily posting refutations to people and just fighting them. Blandly, just telling him, no, it's not, you know, bluntly in what he's saying in very few words, but he's taking the time to do it. But it is a tremendous amount of work in an area that is just saturated with dumbasses who try to make all sorts of parallels. And Christian authors have written about it. They've tried to drag it through the church. There was a time, I think the guy's name is Jim Shaw, who wrote a book that was very much taken to heart by a vast majority of Christians in the United States, probably back in the 80s and 90s. I'm not sure the dates. And it's just, it continues to be the fodder for people to just beat up because no one will say anything about it.
That was a good answer. And I have to agree with you. You mentioned that, or you kind of talked around maybe the, you know, when you really study the ideals of these groups at their core, nothing about them seems nefarious. You know, like even Adam Weishaupt's Bavarian Illuminati group seemed to really be interested in the same things we've been discussing, you know, gnosis, enlightenment of the self and knowledge and things like that. And, you know, these three thinking principles that we've been talking about, this knowledge of self, this direct connection to the divine, I don't see that as a bad thing. I mean, I could see how it is to groups like the church or, you know, Zionist Jews or Muslims or anything like that who really stake their faith in books and intermediaries. So I could see how, you know, I call it a hit job because I guess I might be a little more conspiratorial than you in that sense, but it does seem like there may have been to me just various groups throughout the ages that tried to, you know, squash free thinkers. Obviously, that was the point of the Inquisition, I think. So that's my approach to this sort of conversation, is that it just seems to me that there was a deliberate attempt to kind of, you know, weed out these sorts of free thinking principles from mainstream culture.
Probably, but I mean, the reason behind that. So why? Because it put to task and challenged the powers that be. So the status quo is just changing the status quo. So yeah. It was villainized to the point of being a social evil, if you will. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, that's what was happening. That continues to this day. But, you know, maybe this is some of the reason for why these ideas don't come out. We talked earlier about the movies. Or different mediums of trying to convey these things, maybe because it is the baggage that it comes with. You know, if you were to put Masons in a movie, or if you put the Illuminati in a movie or in a story, they're from the get-go the villain, or at least shadowy enough that their virtue is questionable or their intentions are questionable as to what they're doing. Not so much the case in National Treasure, which I think is why it was a success. But, you know, you mentioned the Illuminati, and who are the Illuminati? The Illuminati's a villain, straight up, but without really knowing about it. So maybe it's our lack of knowledge about them that really conveys the definitions that we run with moving forward. I mean, you know, and some of the things that the Illuminati did purport to do or did want to do was seemed, if memory serves, was a little bit had less than peaceful means. So overthrowing and taking control, but you know, it certainly wasn't a pacifistic, let's just all sit in circles and vote, vote the right way. So maybe in some cases those evil justifications or the evil conclusions of these groups is valid. But, you know, if you throw the rest of the philosophy out with it, you know, Karl Marx gets horrible PR on what he wrote. But if you look at the meat of it, it was, well, to use a bad pun, pretty revolutionary.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But at the heart, it had a good intention of trying to be something for the people.
In the introduction to your Masonic Traveler book, Tim Bryce wrote that we were at the dawn of a Masonic Renaissance. And this was back in 2010 that this book came out. So I'm going to ask you now, here in 2017, have we seen that Masonic Renaissance yet?
I think we have, but I think in the idealistic sense of what we would hoped that it would be, or maybe that was the spirit behind what he was thinking, we haven't. But I don't think that it's for any lack of trying. I think that it's simply, it's like bailing out a boat that you realize too late. The boat is beyond the point of bailing out. Do you follow what I'm saying? So what I mean is that, yes, it was a period of Renaissance, but at the period of Renaissance, if the change, it may have been too late to affect the change that you wanted to affect at the time. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, isn't to say that it isn't still a Renaissance, but it may be a Renaissance in certain areas of it. So in publishing, in podcasts, in websites, there's a profusion of them. And so in that sense, yeah, it's a Renaissance. It's a very good thing. In the sense of changing ideals, I don't think that that's caught up yet. I think that that's still in the works. You know, I don't think that we are at a point yet where some of the ideals of equality and fraternity and liberty are really at play in the systems that we have. And in particular, what I mean is just the allowance of mixed gender Freemasonry, of Freemasonry still functioning at a separate level from African Americans with Prince Hall Freemasonry, not to get into the argument of whether or not Prince Hall wants to be affiliated with quote unquote regular Freemasonry, but the strides to those areas seem to ebb and flow in their intensity, and more so lately that it just seems less than more. And it could be climate, because of climates in society, could be climates in politics, and just general zeitgeist of the age, just that it's not in a place to do it. Whereas maybe 10 years ago, I think that there was more of a feeling that that was a possibility.
Yeah, you know, I've read a lot about the decline in membership throughout the past few decades, but me personally, I've always been drawn to the Masonic ideologies and philosophies. You know, I have a family connection to the Freemasons. My great grandfather was a Freemason. So, you know, I've always been interested in it just for the very reasons that we've been talking about, you know, that I do think it's misunderstood culturally speaking. It was nice to have you here to flesh out, you know, some of the history of Masonic philosophy and where it stands today. I just have one more thing I want to ask you for, and that is, you know, I've always enjoyed the allegory of Hiram Abiff, and I was wondering if you could share that with us, because there's an important lesson in this story for those who don't know, and I think it's a great way to wrap up this conversation.
Hiram is obviously a central figure within the third degree, but the as a central figure, it plays into the quote unquote secrets of Freemasonry as to what takes place and what that means to masonry itself. So I, not to be dodgy after all this, to not go into it, certainly you could read online in a lot of different places, but as trying to hold true to the ideals, I won't give away too much in the sense of how he pertains, because that would be essentially giving away the secret sauce to the burger. It factors, and in my book, the one I'm working on now at the Master Mason, it factors into it, and there is some discussion to it, but the core of what it represents is in the role of the individual going through the degree, assuming the persona, if you will, of Hiram and experiencing what he experiences and what that means in the outcome through the Blue Lodge degrees. So Hiram is a central figure in Freemasonry, suggested symbolically to be the widow's son and the master builder, the master architect of Solomon's Temple. So he's the one that actually is the one leading the work. So the foreman, the overseer, if you will, the superintendent of the building. I want to say in some tradition, he's a worker in brass and metals. He's the one that leads the builders. So the stonemasons, he's drawn the plans. So in effect, the Solomon's Temple is in effect the work of his hand. So the design of his plan, that divine geometry that we talked about so elusively earlier, is his handiwork in the sense of constructing this temple in shaping it in its grounds and so forth. Obviously, again, what we talked about earlier, it's impossible to do a task like that by yourself, but he is the person who superintended the construction of the temple.
I'll leave it at that. I was going to say, I knew you would try to get off on that one. By the way, have you seen Twin Peaks?
Probably going to get eggs thrown at me for it. Way back in the day, I tried to watch it, didn't get into it. I have not tried to watch the new ones yet. I see and hear a lot of things about it.
Well, I was wondering, you know, they have this idea of a white lodge and a black lodge in Twin Peaks, and people try to relate that back to Freemasonry. I was wondering if that's a thing, white lodges and black lodges.
Are you talking in like a philosophical sense, so like a good and bad, or as in like a skin color? The Prince Hall obviously is an African American lodge, and mm-hmm. and not that there are no Caucasian members to it. And vice versa. Regular masonry, is, for the most part, has no prohibition on skin color in the lodge.
Good and evil, I guess.
Yeah, not so much. I mean, it's kind of an interesting concept, but without knowing the deeper context to it, I mean, you could definitely get into some of the deeper symbolism of the pillars, a white pillar, black pillar, but that's probably the extent of it. I couldn't say. I would have to see what the reference is, but it doesn't, besides being an interesting or a anecdotally amusing, I don't know if it's accurate.
I just recorded an episode about Twin Peaks, the original series and the film, you know, prior to this relaunch of the show. So there's a lot of, if you're interested in, you know, a kind of symbolic allegorical mindfuck, I would revisit that show because having saw it when I was younger, I missed a lot of the symbology of the show, and when I was rewatching it to prepare for this recent podcast, a lot of things stood out, a lot of Masonic and occult references and symbols there, so I was just curious about that. But anyways, Greg Stewart, man, this has been a hell of a conversation. I really appreciate you taking so much time here to talk about Freemasonry and the philosophy behind it. Do tell people where they can find your work if they want more Greg Stewart.
Absolutely. So I publish and run a website, freemasoninformation.com. You can find a lot of my writings there under the tag for Masonic Traveler. Or if the socials are more your thing, these days I tend to haunt Twitter way more than I should. But I'm on Twitter under Masonic Traveler, which should be fairly easy to find. I don't do Facebook as much anymore. Pretty much not at all. Which for other reasons that I'd be happy to talk about another time that have to do with privacy and information collection. And I also have started making the last couple of years videos for YouTube and exploring that. So, You can find me on all those. If you're interested, just hit me up on Twitter. I'd love to chat and tell me how wrong I am on stuff or how right I am on others.
Absolutely, man. Well, yeah, I've really enjoyed the chat, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime soon about anything, because I really, really do admire your stance and your own personal philosophy on these sorts of things. So thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm really grateful for you asking me to do it. I appreciate it a lot. It was a lot of fun. I haven't done a podcast in a long time, so.
Hell to the yes. Greg Stewart coming through in the clutch to help deliver our longest transmission to date. My thanks again to him for sticking around so long. I would absolutely recommend giving his work a good once over at the least. Both his website and his books are linked in the show notes. And if 2+ hours of Greg Stewart wasn't enough, stay tuned over the next couple weeks, because Greg and I actually spoke for about 40 or 45 minutes the night before we recorded this conversation you just heard, so be on the lookout for a few extra minutes from us in the near future. And what more can you really add to a conversation like this? I guess my biggest takeaway was, if you follow pop culture or are privy to any sort of conspiracy theories, the Freemasons are a controversial and often demonized group linked to all sorts of nefariousness. And personally, I'd have to ask why, because if these connections that Greg outlines to Hermeticism, Gnosticism, and other esoteric and occult teachings, if these do connect to the original spirit of Freemasonry, I can see why the group would be demonized in pop culture. Empire is not too fond of teaching and preaching self-empowerment to the masses. Of course, I can't discount the notion that perhaps one bad apple at the top of the pyramid may spoil the infrastructure below it as well. Regardless, if you're delivering a positive message, I'm gonna listen. We all should. We shouldn't get sucked into this whole, oh, this person's affiliated with this group, so they must be spreading lies and drinking baby's blood. I mean, come on. Judge not, lest ye be judged, as they used to say on the streets of Sodom and Gomorrah. Anyway, I did want to apologize again for the quality there from Greg's end. His voice personally sounded great, but that microphone was a pain in the ass from time to time. He messed with it multiple times and we couldn't figure it out, and I guess we could have switched to the phone, but that's not always the best quality either. Honestly, I need a better, more advanced software solution. I'm using a free program to record this and would love to upgrade to something more professional and more dynamic. I'd also like to upgrade my own hardware, so if you can spare a shekel or two, as my contemporary Miguel Connor would say over at Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio, please do consider supporting the show by visiting occulturepodcast.com/support. One-time donations are accepted through PayPal, as well as recurring monthly donations. A few different options there. And if you have any Bitcoin you want to part with, you can send that on over our way too. And speaking of donations, huge thank you to Michael Kovacic. Michael has now moved beyond this realm of human incarnation and has become a truly enlightened being, because he's now contributing to the show at the Ascended Master level, $13.13 a month. Much appreciated, my man. And you know, I'm not selling Gatorade here, but everyone should strive to be like Mike. Also, some quick news on the Patreon campaign that I've mentioned a couple times already. I've begun to flesh that out with ideas for rewards and bonus content. It's really cool so far, I think, because I'm trying to pull in stuff that utilizes the work and talents of people I've come to know through this podcast and other podcasts, because I want to make something truly unique for the supporters of this show. Of course, nothing's final yet, but to this point, I'm pretty excited about that. Still a few months away, at least, because there's a lot of details to work through and iron out, and unfortunately, as of right now, I'm just a one-man gang here. What I also am is getting the hell out of here for right now. Thank you for sticking around this long. You've just been initiated into occulture. I am Ryan Peverly, reminding you to love yourself, think for yourself, and question authority. I'm gonna go get some more.
Please rewind this cassette.